Today's program is brought to you by Junior's. You have not really lived until you've had cheesecake at Junior's. For more information, visit juniorscheesecake.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Eating Matters, a weekly conversation about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm Kim Kessler with the Resnick Program for Food Law and Policy at UCLA Law School, and we are broadcasting live from Brooklyn on Heritage Radio Network. And joining me today as co-host in the studio is Evan Hanser. He's the chef at Egg Restaurant in Williamsburg, and he's been with us here before as co-host. Welcome back, Evan. Glad to have you.
Thank you very much, Kim.
The issue of labor in the food system has received more national attention in recent years, but while there may be growing awareness among some parts of the customer and consumer base of the need to treat people that produce our food more fairly, our next guest's reporting demonstrated how desperately greater attention is needed. Richard Morosi's series on Mexican farm laborers for the Los Angeles Times exposed in devastating detail the labor system that many U.S.-based retailers rely on for Mexican produce. The series documented some substandard living conditions for the workers, who sometimes lacked access to clean water or functioning toilets and were subject to exploitive wage practices. The series was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2015, and I am pleased to welcome reporter Richard Morosi to the program. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kim. Thanks for having me on.
We're very glad to have you. So I wanted to start with your background. You've reported extensively from the U.S.-Mexico border, covering everything from cartels to immigration issues. What first brought the farm labor issue to your attention?
Well, at first, it came through kind of a serendipitous route. I'd been doing stories on immigrants, and through my travels in Mexico, I had run across some labor camps and fields where I had been told children were working, and that kind of piqued my interest. And as I dug into the story, it revealed even more abusive, exploitative conditions that I even imagined, and it went far beyond just child labor, which was mainly just restricted in chili peppers and smaller growers. At the big, huge agribusinesses that supply much of our winter produce, there were labor camps lining these roads across Sinaloa and Baja California. And these were kind of hidden worlds. Journalists hadn't accessed these areas very often in the past. We managed to get inside a lot of these labor camps and document some of the conditions in there, which were slave-like.
How do you begin that process?
Well, there's no set way. You know, these places are pretty isolated down long dirt roads and cartel areas of Mexico. So you go in there and you try and talk to these folks, usually outside, but we managed to go inside. I was accompanied by Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer Donald Bartletti. Usually we would get half an hour to an hour inside the camp before the camp overseers knew we were there and kicked us out. But in that time, we were able to gather up a lot of information and document a lot of the abuses going on. And then later, we linked some of these labor camps to growers who supplied America's biggest retailers, including Safeway and Walmart, and also big restaurant chains.
So tell us in a little bit more detail, you know, the daily life in the camps, what it looked like for the people who were living there.
Well, these are Mexico's poorest people. They're usually indigenous people who are bused in from hundreds of miles away to work in these labor camps, usually through 3 to 6 months at a time. They live in these low-slung, tin-shacked warehouse-like dorms. And it's work 6 days a week from 4 a.m. to 6 p.m. They generally get two bowls of lentil soup a day, a kilo of tortillas, and, you know, work in the fields or in the packing sheds. Most people don't realize 50% of the tomatoes that we eat in this country now come from Mexico. The Mexican growers are very good at growing good quality produce and getting here on time on our store shelves. But the laborers would complain, hey, you know, all this effort goes to pamper produce, and they live, you know, hardly better than animals. What happens is in these dorms, often they don't have beds, they'll sleep on bare floors, right? So in addition to not having enough food, they're cold in the winter, and then summertime they're really, really hot because the walls are made of corrugated iron, and it's without insulation, so it gets very hot in the summer, very cold in the winter times. And there's also limited access to water. They have to bathe in irrigation canals a lot of times. They have to do their laundry in irrigation canals, which creates, you know, food safety issues as well as hygiene issues for the laborers.
You describe the laborers, including many indigenous people and coming from far away. How does that start? Like, how do you become a farm laborer in Mexico?
Well, usually these folks live in tiny mountain villages, and they hear ads along the radio. You know, usually they're sing-songy, happy ads saying, come work, make a lot of money, go to Sinaloa, and come back, you know, with a lot of pesos in your pockets. And these people, with limited opportunities, they'll get their, you know, little rucksack and march and walk or take buses down to the little gathering areas in these small hubs in these mountain towns and board buses, and they'll travel 500 miles up to the big agribusiness businesses, which are concentrated mainly in the western state of Sinaloa, also Sonora and Baja California. And they'll spend 3 to 6 months there. What I saw and what I thought was the most alarming thing was these camps are basically, you know, ringed with barbed wire, which limits their movement. And another practice that limits their mobility is the fact that they're not paid often until the end of the 3 months. So they're essentially trapped in these places. They can't leave because they don't have, even if they wanted to leave, they don't have money to leave.
Right.
Now, that is in direct violation of Mexican federal law that says they have to be paid weekly. They're not paid weekly. So often you'll show up at these camps and these people are begging you for money, or on their days off they're going to work side jobs so they can, earn $4 or $5 to drink a beer or get a little or tortilla or something, right?
Do they have any way of knowing their rights?
You know, these are mostly come from regions where people have limited access to education or representation. And though a lot of the younger folks have more education than the older folks, they don't have nowhere to turn. They're not represented by any folks. There's no, you know, labor attorneys out there looking to organize or make collective actions against these agribusinesses. These people are folks with meager resources and limited access to representation. So they're exploited. They're exploitable. So they're exploited.
So one of the things that comes across in your reporting is just this incredible portrait of the children who are involved in working, which I know is just one aspect of the supply chain there. But, you know, you're telling particularly one story of a 12-year-old girl, I think she's 12, and her name is Alejandra. Alejandra or Alejandrina?
Alejandrina.
Alejandrina, yes. So can you tell us about her and her daily life?
Well, Alejandrina came from a small village in Guerrero, and she had been through school until she was about 9 years old, and then embarked on a nomadic journey across Mexico, just chasing the chili pepper harvest from Sinaloa through Guanajuato and up through Chihuahua. So she hadn't received regular schooling for years by the time I met her when she was, I think, 12 years old. And, you know, her life was one of tremendous hardship, living in these fall-down shacks with her extended family and getting up with the sunrise and heading to the chili pepper fields, working till noon, and getting finally something to eat. She was always very hungry at noon when the food truck would come, and then working till the sun came down, and then heading home and doing that every day for 6 days a week. And with really no future, no opportunities, and very, very little hope for improving her living situation.
I mean, one of the things in the story that's so compelling is the photos. You talked about your colleague that you reported with, but because you can see in these pictures, there's still this joy, this childlike joy that comes across her face in different circumstances, despite the hardships, you know, just makes it so accessible, I think, her humanity, really. And I wanted to just ask you about that relationship, because you said you did track her for over a year, and if you're still in touch with her, and how her family's doing.
Yeah, it's hard keeping in touch with her. Her labor was controlled by a field boss, and that was my only contact. And these people are nomads; they're just constantly on the move throughout Mexico, and they're poor. And you know, if they don't charge their phones, you pretty much lose access. And tracking them down is very difficult. The last time I checked in with them, they were in this region in southern Sinaloa called Esquinapa area, where there's huge chili pepper fields. That's where America gets a lot of its chili peppers. And she's probably there right now. They're usually there in the winter time for several months. But like I said, it's very, very difficult keeping in touch with these folks. And heck, I mean, she was 12 years old. She's 13 now, I believe. She's, in life here, if she was here, she'd be a normal schoolgirl. She was very bright. She had ambitions of being a school teacher. But even in her limited circumstances, she made the best of it, because she was one of the fastest pickers among her group of kids, right? Everybody looked to beat her, but she would always beat them picking, you know, several 30 or 40 pound sacks of a day, right? So the more sacks you pick, the more money you earn. And she'd buy little trinkets once in a while, get a little lipstick or anything, you know, to brighten her days.
And that that motivation to really, you know, to pick faster and make more money, does that actually offer any potential path out of this situation? Or is it kind of a futile pursuit?
No, I mean, it's all it's going to get you is a few extra pesos at the end of the day. You know, it's not a meritocracy, right? You know, and there's very few female field bosses, none actually. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, her potential is limited in that field. You basically there is no fast track. I mean, in that society with these indigenous folks, she'll probably be married, by 17, 18, and start having children. And a lot of these women, you know, they're pregnant. They're out working the fields, and they have their kid, and then a month or two, they're right back in the fields with their kids strapped to their backs, you know. You see a lot of infants. You see a lot of babies out there in the field in their diapers crawling through the mud. It's very sad.
And can you also did delve into some of the health aspects of being in these conditions and the exposures that the laborers experience and the lack of access to medical care. How did that impact the people who you got to speak with?
I think, I mean, for a lot of these folks like Alejandrina, the greatest danger is traveling. There was one photo that Don Bartletti took, was amazing, you know, 18, 19 people strapped to the back of an open bed truck, you know, going down freeways 50, 60 miles an hour. Traffic accidents are common throughout Mexico during the harvest season. It's scary how many people die or are injured, you know, hundreds yearly. Alejandrina's family was touched by it. Her relatives were on a truck that flipped over, and the day I visited, you know, four of them were strewn on the ground, you know, on beds, recovering from broken ribs or cracked heads and with very little medical care, right? These people have nowhere to turn to. So that's a major issue, the lack of safe transport to and from the fields. And also the bathing in irrigation canals creates a whole host of other issues. Lots of kids get skin infections. I saw it all over the place.
Like pesticide related or fungus related, or
you know,
just the lack of sanitation?
It's hard to pin down, and I didn't have time to look into that, but probably some of the experts I talked to said, yeah, it could be pesticide related. You know, a lot of these irrigation canals, you can see water snakes, you know, running through them. So they can get bit. I mean, there are rodent infestations in a lot of this slum housing where they live. There's all sorts of hazards.
So I want to just ask you one more question, and then we'll take a short break. But
sure.
How, you know, the trust aspect of getting to talk to folks when you have these barbed wire enclosures and, you know, the kinds of lack of resources that they had or fear that they may have been living with, how would you be able to engage them? Or did you find that they were eager to get their stories out?
You know, these people, no one talks to these folks. No one talks to these folks about the hardships. So I show up, I tell them I'm a reporter from El Norte, right? And they just open up. I mean, you just can't get many of them to shut up, right? And but one guy said it all. I mean, and they say the most pithy things, these folks. One guy working at this one camp in Sinaloa, young man who said, you know, living on two bowls of lentil soup a day and working 10 hours a day was very trying. And he says, hey, we come to this camp fat and we leave skinny, he says.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that says it all. You know, these people are starving.
Yeah.
Right? And they go on and on and on about their hardships. It's some of them express a little fear about having their names in the paper, but most of them don't. And it's not like they see reporters or talk to reporters or talk to anybody who cares about their lives every day. You know, these people are very willing to explain what's going on in their daily lives.
So I want to take a short break and then come back and talk more about the bigger system, which you explained a lot, and some of the things
sure.
that have happened since your reporting about a year ago.
Sure.
Let's play a game. If I say three words, let's say Brooklyn, classic, food. You tell me what comes to mind. I'll give you a second. If the answer wasn't Junior's, you lose the game. You can't possibly be a Brooklyn foodie, or a foodie at all for that matter, and not know about Junior's. Founded by Harry Rosen in 1950, Junior's landmark restaurant is known as the home of New York's best cheesecake. Real talk, you have not fully lived unless you've had Junior's Cheesecake. The original location in Brooklyn on Flatbush Avenue is still thriving, or you can check them out at recent landmark additions in New York's Grand Central Terminal or in the heart of the Theater District on Broadway and Times Square. Check out their first restaurant outside of New York at the Fox Tower Hotel at Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut. It's not just cheesecakes. They've got steak, seafood, sandwiches, salad, everything you would possibly need to complete an authentic New York dining experience. Don't be embarrassed next time somebody asks you if you've been to Junior's. Visit juniorscheesecake.com for more information.
And we're back on Eating Matters with Rich Morosi of the Los Angeles Times talking about farm laborers in Mexico.
So, Rich, we were just talking about during the break how kind of powerfully the stories you were able to access there are, and kind of from a journalistic perspective, the images that you're able to pair with those. Do you see, I guess, what sort of reach do you see those having in Mexico or in the U.S.? I mean, obviously, there are many readers of the LA Times who saw that article, I'm sure, were deeply impacted by it. But what's the Mexican perspective on the situation? How well known is this sort of situation among other, you know, people in Mexico?
Well, the story about abusive conditions amongst Mexican farm laborers is not a story in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not a story here. Everybody knows these folks don't have good lives, and they live miserably. The reason it's a story is because it's directly related to the supply chain to America's biggest retailers, mm-hmm. who claim to have social responsible supply chains,
mm-hmm.
right, and practices, and spell them out in detail on their corporate websites, okay? So to me, it's more of a story of corporate malfeasance and corporate deceit than it is really about abusive living conditions because, you know, if this had been a story about poor Mexicans working to produce produce for other Mexicans, it's not a story for the LA Times, and that wouldn't get much reader interest in the United States. The only reason I think this story resonated is because it's linked to the everyday eating practices of Americans, right? The produce that they pick ends up on our store shelves, right? And we're led to believe that these people are treated responsibly in a lawful manner. But I found evidence otherwise.
Yeah, and it seems to align kind of pretty neatly with the way American consciousness around good food or food in general has lined up, where there's a great concern about the way food is grown and certain standards about the produce itself, but not a lot of attention paid to the labor behind it. You mentioned, I think, examples of inspectors from the U.S., from corporations, checking in on food safety and food quality, but really ignoring these labor issues. What is there to be done about that?
Well, I mean, after the story came out, the Mexican government formed this big social responsibility alliance of trade groups and pledging to improve the lives of 1 million farm workers, right? Walmart said they were going to bolster their reforms, and some other retailers said the same, right? But they can talk all they want, what's going on the ground. I've got some evidence that things are improving, and other evidence that it really isn't improving much at all. But it's hard to tell because there's no regular oversight. You know, there's no regular media attention given to these issues. My understanding is that in a lot of these labor camps across Mexico, they've beefed up security, so it's not easy for outsiders to really gain access anymore, right? So it's hard to know exactly what's going on and if they're following through on their pledges. That said, folks in the industry insist that things are getting better and that the series was really a game changer for them, that they can't afford to marginalize or look bad with consumers in this day and age, because consumers really, really do care about these issues. That's one of the things that they're very sensitive about, and we were really shocked, actually, in speaking with some growers and some retailers, that these issues have resonance with consumers. They really care, especially younger consumers. Folks at Driscoll's Berries, who were hit with a berry strike in Baja California, they said, consumer behavior really affects their sales. And so they've been trying to institute reforms and better working conditions at the growers that they are partnered with in Mexico.
Were there any organizations that really picked up your work? Obviously it's you're a reporter and your role ends at a certain point. Were there people who took this on to make it an advocacy campaign or priority and are still doing that work?
It's hard. In Mexico, sure, there are unions. There are some indigenous leaders and fledgling union groups, but it's really difficult to organize these folks down there because they come from very poor regions. They're not a local workforce. They're desperately poor. And the agribusinesses are extremely wealthy owners and politically connected, right? And there's a history of squashing labor movements in Mexico, sometimes violently. So, no, there hasn't really been a really strong effort in some of these areas to organize or address these issues. That said, in Baja California, there is a labor movement forming, one of the strongest in recent years, in decades, actually. Interestingly, the leaders of that movement were people who had spent time working in the fields in the United States and had been exposed to the United Farm Workers and their organizing practices, and also the Immokalee group out there.
Right, CIW, right.
So they're kind of adopting those methods and things that they've learned in the U.S. and trying to apply it in Mexico, and they've had some success. That strike led to a historic increase in wages, first in decades, for farm workers in Mexico.
What did companies tell you about how this could happen when they had certain pledges? Or, did they say that there are barriers, there are reasons they can't guarantee this? Or, what was the response when you were exposing what was going on in some of the supply chains?
Well, for the most part, most retailers wouldn't comment, or said that they would just gave vague statements about being concerned and that they were going to review their supply chain practices, right? Walmart, to their credit, was the only one who really gave me detailed responses. They have a social responsibility team on the ground in Mexico, right, apparently. So They were in some of the camps that I was in and saw the same conditions that I was in. So it raises questions about whether or not what they're doing, or whether they're even enforcing these rules that they have. You talk to the growers down there, and they say that, yeah, Walmart is there, and they're very strict, but I didn't see evidence in a lot of these camps that they were enforcing their own standards, right? They said they're going to step up enforcement, but they've been very vague about how they're going to do that. And you talk to growers down there who want to do the right thing, and they'll just tell you, you know, if we improve living conditions and working conditions for our folks, we can't contract with what we can't get hit Walmart's price point.
Right.
Yeah, so they say, well, you know, these improving living standards is incompatible with the Walmart model, is what they say. Or some of them, with some of the better reputation for treating their workers, don't sell to Walmart. They just they can't keep prices low enough for them. So there's this conflict there, and Walmart is, you know, they're not really been open to addressing that.
Yeah, and so how is that addressed? Does that come from consumers kind of making it clear that they're willing to pay more, or desire to pay more for, you know, for these conditions to improve? Does it come from the company is just taking that step up? And do you have a sense of what that cost impact would be to improve conditions, well, you know, to even some sort of reasonable level?
There haven't been many surveys, but some of the surveys say to raise their wages just a little bit, you know, would increase consumer costs like 60 cents a year, really nothing. If you buy about a $2 a pound packet of tomatoes, right, less than half a cent of that is going to the worker that picked it. Okay. So there's plenty of room to improve their salaries without really increasing the price for consumers. But it's hard to... I mean, they sweat, you know, in the produce, which is a volume market, it's a volume business, they sweat every penny, you know, a margin, right? So that's going to affect their profit margins, and they put, you know, they don't want to increase costs in any way, even if it just amounts to a couple of pennies more for workers down there. I mean, the average they make $6 to $8 a day.
is that the model that the Avesky groups in Baja California are adopting now? Because it sounds like the CIW approach, where their goal was just to get, you know, a penny more per pound for tomatoes, and to show how big of an impact that would make on workers' lives.
Yeah,
is that kind of the similar approach being taken by those groups that are being organized by former workers?
No, they can't. I mean, the Coalition of Bakali Workers, as good as they do in the United States, you know, there's no sign that they're going to be going down to Mexico. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're busy expanding their labor movement north, right? But in Mexico, it's hard, and it's hard to organize in Mexico. It requires a lot of time, and a lot of folks, basically, I'll tell you straight up, you know, they're scared of the potential violence, the specter of violence, right? I mean, I know executives from these big retailers don't go to these regions. That's one of the reasons they don't really keep tabs on their supply chains, right? Mm-hmm. Because they don't go down. They fear violence. They fear the crime situation in a lot of these regions, so they don't go.
Your reporting indicated that there had been a real increase in these exports from Mexico in the last decade. What led to that, and what are the is trade a role? Is there a role for American government, and is there a trade system affecting this?
No, I mean, largely consumer demand. We want fresh produce year round, right? And Mexico has filled a need, right? Especially for the winter produce. But they got into this big time 15, 20 years ago, but in recent years have expanded dramatically, in part because they've developed really, really good technology and growing technology adopted from Spain and the Dutch and Israelis. And they've built these huge industrial scale complexes that are visible. They're so big, they're visible from space, these big greenhouse complexes, right? Mm. So they're able to mass produce these vegetables at a very good price and very good quality, right? And now it's not just a winter product, it's year-round. And it's not just tomatoes, it's cucumbers, it's bell peppers, it's melons, it's grapes, it's everything. So it's become a really, really big business, and in many ways a success story for Mexico, right? Yeah. Which is pushing their, you know, this economic miracle and as an export, emerging export powerhouse.
And so that being such a huge part of our produce imports and our diet as American consumers, and it sounds like change is unlikely to come from inside Mexico. What can any average American consumer do, if anything? Maybe this is just a loss of a situation, but to affect some sort of change in it.
Apparently what works, the one, like you said, the change doesn't come from within Mexico. But believe me, these Mexican growers are very, very sensitive to the U.S. market, mm-hmm. right, and supply and demand here. If the perception that they're going to lose business because consumers are going to shy away from that, they will change. Believe me, that's I found out. Mm-hmm. The U.S. consumer has tremendous leverage over what happens in Mexico if they organize. And what simply going into your local supermarket and asking the produce guy, hey, where does this produce come from? Mm-hmm. What are your supply chain standards? How do you enforce them, right? You ask those questions. I mean, you'll see nowadays, especially much of the, go to the tomato bin, mm-hmm. pull a tomato, it's going to say product of Mexico, right? So, query the manager there, hey, where does this come from? Who produced it? Which part of Mexico did it come from? Mm-hmm. Let me see your standards. Are you enforcing these standards? Apparently that has an impact. and especially from the younger consumers apparently are very much attuned to this. And really, if they act collectively, what I've learned is they can really, really move markets.
Yeah.
That's one thing I've learned out of all this, especially in the Baja strike. That really, really apparently hurt Driscoll's, which is the world's largest berry distributor, and they have big operations down there. Ironically, they're one of the better producers down there who treat their people much better than the local Mexican growers do. But they were targeted by the labor movement because they're the most vulnerable. They have a brand to protect, right?
Yeah.
So Driscoll's was hit hard, apparently, by this boycott threat, though they were never actually formally boycotted Driscoll's. It took on a life of its own. Mm-hmm. So Driscoll's pressured the Mexican government to end the strike, which led to the biggest salary increase in recent Mexican history, right? And Driscoll's executives have taken the lead in this big social responsibility alliance to kind of drag their colleagues, their fellow growers into the future and treat their people better, right? And, of course, they have an interest. Driscoll's has a big interest in improving the situation for everybody because they're the ones who were smeared when these labor movements rise, right?
Yeah. Well, it's nice to think that there's room for some success story in all of this.
Yeah, it's ongoing, and they caution it's going to take time. Things move really slowly, but also that can be an excuse. I mean, if they wanted to change it, they could do it overnight, right? I mean, as a result of my reporting, apparently a lot of these hundreds of beds were distributed, and they got rid of these high-priced company stores and replaced them with at-cost company stores where people didn't, the laborers wouldn't fall into debt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if we really covered that, but you reported on people having to buy at these stores that were overpriced.
Yeah. They price everyday items to double, triple, quadruple the price of a neighborhood store, so a lot of the money they earn just goes right back to the company, right?
Right.
And they leave owing money, or they can't leave sometimes mm-hmm. because their debts are too deep, and they're prevented from leaving until they pay off the debt. So it's just this cycle. It just comes in and goes right back out.
Yeah.
But apparently they've closed down some of these, and they're putting in other company stores that are government-run and sell those items at cost.
For you, as you personally, having had that some of the outcomes that did come from this, and in some of your follow-up stories, you having workers attest to some of the improved conditions, what's your own reflection on that? How does that feel for you as a reporter?
Well, the thing is, it's hard to really get a sense of how widespread this is. You feel heartened when you call and you say things are getting better, but that was months ago, and it's hard to check in with these people. I haven't been to Sinaloa recently, and I don't know if I have any plans or to go there or any other places to see if these pledges are actually being acted on.
Because you wouldn't be a good reporter if you didn't have this complete skepticism and need to verify this.
The more I work on these issues and the more I travel down there, I mean, all of these government corporate pledges don't mean anything, you know, often. Often it's just meant to buy time, okay, you know, to get people to just back off, right? And unless people are out there scrutinizing these pledges, they'll just fall back to their old ways, right? And that's a common problem, especially in Mexico, where there isn't a lot of media scrutiny. And the state of journalism down there, my profession is very weak right now, and they're under siege, really. Journalists don't have the time. Journalists are being killed. Right. Journalists self-censor, and to go into these labor camps and take on these big, powerful agribusinesses. You know, sometimes their editors don't want that, or it requires a lot of resources to tell the bigger picture and how these agribusinesses are linked to the big U.S. supply chains, right? So it's complex reporting that requires a lot of resources and time, and unfortunately, a lot of Mexican journalists don't have the resources to pull it off.
Yeah.
Though they have the will and the passion, but... Mm-hmm. The realities just keep them from reporting in depth.
I do want to encourage people to read the series, and also you referenced a few times the photography and videography by Don Bartletti, and some of the images really are stunning. So I'd encourage people to check out the series if you haven't. And I want to thank you, Rich, for joining us today. We're really glad to have you on.
Hey, no, it was great. And thanks for your interest, and thanks for sharing it.
Evan, thanks for joining as co-host. That's our show for today. Our show co-producer is Jenna Liute, and our intern is Austin Brynjarski. The show music is by Tim Archer. Thanks to our sponsors and our show engineer, Liz Smith. The show is available on Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast at iTunes and Stitcher. And you can also find us on Twitter at EatMattersHRN. I'm Kim Kessler, and thank you for listening.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.